It's time to introduce our lovely speaker. We have Martha R. from the Friday Night Big Book Meeting in Cressona. Right? Complete darkness.
Hi, I'm Martha. I'm an alcoholic. I know it's polite to thank the speaker-getter and the group for inviting me. But I don't like doing this. But I do thank you, I guess. I have to be polite. It's not really fun to do this. But my life's not really based all around fun anymore. For most of my life, all I wanted was fun. I couldn't be responsible, couldn't show up. And I find now, too, by showing up and doing the things I have to do, I can, I might even be able to make this fun. You know, I know that says that we're going to have a new freedom and a new happiness. This is definitely a new happiness. It looks completely different from what I was always searching for before. So with that said, I have a lot of fear going on. My sponsor had said, if I have fear, I have agnosticism, and that's exactly how she would say it, agnosticism. And that means I'm not trusting God, so I'm going to trust God here. I know I'll survive this, and I'm pretty sure you guys will too. Anyway, my sobriety date is December 14th, 2009. I have a home group, and it's the Friday Night Big Book Meeting up in Cressona. That's kind of near Pottsville. I have a sponsor. I've been sponsored through the 12 steps as outlined in the book and in the timing it kind of requires. So thank God for that. I sponsor other women, so that's good. I guess I just have to tell you a little bit. I can't make this up. You get nervous up here, but all I can do is tell you what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. I was one of six kids, and we were all like a year or less apart in age. There's like two sets of Irish twins. My childhood, there was nothing, sometimes I wish, this is sort of stupid, but I sort of wish that there was something that had happened to me, or there was some big calamity, or something that was bad that I could point to as to why I didn't feel good. Why I just had, troubles or failure to, I call it failure to thrive. I know they, call newborns sometimes, that they can't really identify what it is, but just failure to thrive. And that's how I sort of felt. So I look back on my childhood, there's nothing, I was raised middle class, lower middle class family. If there were problems, I tended to ignore them. I didn't pay attention. My sisters and my brother saw things differently than I did. They would say, aren't you upset about this? Aren't you alarmed by that? And I'd be like, what are you talking about? So I ignored everything. I had this attitude of, if you didn't pay attention, if you ignored it and just thought positively, it would all go away and all good things would happen. I don't remember when I took my first drink, but I remember my first drunk. I was in eighth grade. We went up to my friend Sue's house. There was like 10 of us. And I started drinking gin. And I was the only one that kept drinking gin. I was the only one that got really drunk. I was the only one that got sick. I was the only one that, I was the one that got caught. I was the one that affected everybody. From my first drunk, I affected other people. I got my friend Sue in trouble. I got my sister in to try to help hide me from my parents. That didn't work. Lying. My first drunk was bad behavior from day one. I don't really remember the next time I drank again. I know I was very sick. But I can't remember. Some people say, oh, it was the best thing. You know, I remember the sense of ease and comfort. I don't remember that. I remembered it was fun, what I could read, like some the part of it until you had, you know, you crossed that line. There was no fun anymore. But for a while, it was fun that night. I just know that when I really took a look back, and as I said, a lot of things were hazy because I ignored everything. But I know within a few weeks, I was starting to take, you know, stealing liquor from my parents' cabinet and stopping in the woods. This is in middle school, you know, stopping in the woods, walking to school, stopping in the woods, and drinking something, anything, you know, a little bit. Other stuff came into play within a couple weeks, I think, of doing that, you know. I know as when I was young, in elementary school, you know, I was always respectful. You know, I did well in school. I wanted to please the teachers. I was a good kid. I wanted to please my parents. I got good grades. I was active in activities. But soon after, by the time I got to high school, the grades started slipping a little bit. You know, the sports went out the window. You know, the party became my main focus. It was funny because even when you think back at that point, too, you know, it says we have like moral and philosophical convictions galore. Even in high school, like I knew I was starting to be like, I hate to call it this, but the evil twin was coming out. Do you know what I mean? I was getting further and further away from what I believed in, what I kind of knew as how I wanted to be, had always been. So now, like, that other face was even starting to come out, that face of, you know, pretending on the outside to be respectful, pretending that I was still a good kid, that I was behaving properly. But I was lying. You know, I know a lot of people talk about that. You know, we have this other face we're putting out for everyone else to see. And I was just pretending, you know, to start hiding. But I was doing things that I shouldn't be doing, but I was pretending I wasn't. And the lying started. Once again, I didn't really have any major big consequences in high school. I didn't get arrested. I didn't, you know, I graduated. I had friends. I had boyfriends. You know, I was a part of, even though it was mostly a part of the party scene. But it was... But I would hang out with, you know, some of my siblings were still good. Do you know what I mean? They viewed me as, and I grabbed onto this, they viewed me as the free spirit. I don't know if anybody else can identify with that. You know, and I thought, ooh, that's what I am. I'm a free spirit. You know, and so that could identify, you know, it could make me be different, allow myself to be different. And I really grabbed onto that. Even in high school, I started even thinking that I was I was born 10 years too late. Because I really would have fit in with the 60s and the early 70s. You know, and I would say that often. You know, but then also I would add that little caveat. Thank God I wasn't born then because I'd be dead. But I also often wish my personality lent itself to that time frame. And so I kind of tried to channel that. I don't know where I was, but I was, you know, as I said, I was the free spirit. My friends, my siblings, I'd be the one that would get lost, wouldn't show, you know, all of a sudden I'd disappear. We'd be at parties. Where'd Martha go? Where'd Martha go? Where'd, you know, and I would come back all, you know, who knows what. And I wouldn't even worry about that everybody was looking for me or was, you know, afraid for me. And I came back like, oh, you have no idea. I'm just like in a whole different realm. I was just like such a hippie and thought it was great. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not going to go too far into that, but it's just amazing how I was. Graduated from high school, as I said, no real consequences. But you know, I have to look, too, and this happens to a lot of us. You get out of high school, and fear really sets in because you have to. I was going to college. Mind you, I was only going half hour down the road to the University of Delaware, and I already had siblings there. My mother worked there. But still, it was that whole thing of knowing that I didn't know what I was doing. I knew that I was a little bit afraid already of the way I was drinking and carrying on. And I knew that in college, who's going to, you know, how am I going to keep that under control? And the same token, you're all excited because you know you could do that. And that's the college experience. And somehow I'd figure it out. You know, the first semester, I, you know, made it through the semester, but had to move home because I was scared to death. By the next few semesters, you know, I didn't really go to class that often. It was funny because one class I just stopped going to because, you know why? I had to get up in front of a lot of people and speak. I just stopped going. And it was funny because it affected my I know my dad had helped me. I was actually an animal science major. I was going into farming because I'm a hippie. And, you know, my dad had really helped me you know, got me hooked up with this man about tractors, and I was doing this report and doing all this, you know, it was on, you know, ag engineering, all this other kind of stuff. And my father put a lot of effort into it, and I just stopped going, you know, after all the effort he put into hook me up with this guy. I don't even want to go into the stories about college. It's ridiculous. Most of us, anybody who's had, you know, I mean, most of us have had that wild phase that you just, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. This was starting to hit really. Yeah, in high school I started feeling like, getting that thing, something's wrong with me. Do you know what I mean? You start getting that, like, there's something wrong with me. But we couldn't dare tell anybody. You know, you couldn't, how are you supposed to say that? You know, talk to your friends, to your family, to people you're trying to impress. You know, there's something wrong with me. So in college, it was really becoming apparent. My friends were able to kind of manage and to be able to get through classes. They could go out, but they could leave and go home. I couldn't do that. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I would, you know, go out and say, I'm only going to have a couple. And then it's 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And either you can make it to class and you're hungover, or I just wouldn't go. And then call the professor and make up horrible stories as to why I couldn't show. The best line that I was giving the professors at the time, and it's really pretty bad, but you know, I would tell them, and I'd just call them and say, something so horrible happened to me last night. And I can't talk about it. But with a poor guy. Do you know what I mean? And I would be like kind of weepy in tears. And he would be, you know, and the professors would be like, oh my God, are you all right? Do you need to get some help? Do you need some therapy? You know, all this stuff. And I would let them think that the most horrible thing happened to me. And that's why I couldn't go to class. I couldn't show up for the exam. And they would give me a reprieve. You know, the other things that happened in college too, and this started happening. I don't know if anybody else has ever done this either. You know, it really became apparent once I did my inventory. But so many people, so many of the things I went out to go try to do, it was like I was writing a book. I wanted to like kind of just have a life experience. I wanted to chalk it up to, you know, oh, this would look good when I go tell my story later on. I don't know if I, you know what I mean? You just like say, oh, this is a good one. I can't wait to be telling people this later on when I reminisce about my life. I'm not going to go into detail what some of those were, but I was like, I'm living. And that brings me back to the point of the way, how I was raised. I said I was one of 6 kids, and we're all really close in age. And my mother, you know, on the outside, she'd look okay. She looked kind of worn out. But our laundry room was in the basement. And I would go down the basement, you know, or I'd peek down to, like, say, hey, Mom, what are you doing? And she'd be crying. And I caught her like that a lot. And then she would come up, wipe her eyes, wipe her tears, and come back up and just try to plug through the day. But then when she would get together with the neighbors, And she was really pretty. And I saw pictures of her when she was young. And she was Miss Kate May. She was, you know, she was and just friendly and nice and a beautiful person. And I would see her in the drudgery and the horribleness of the six kids. And I would think, what the hell is this all? Who would want this? But then when I'd see her with the neighbors, you know, they'd get together and she would have some drinks and she would become beautiful again. And she'd be laughing and she'd be flirting and she looked gorgeous. And then the other, you know, and I've viewed my father, you know, as trying to make enough money to support these kids. And he would go to the racetrack. He would go, we had one car, and he would go to the racetrack or he would go to the Columbus Inn with his friends. And my mother would be sitting outside, you know, looking through the little window, waiting for him to come home. Where is your father? Because we needed to get places. We were trying to get to whatever it was, to work, extracurricular activities. And she'd always be like, where is your father? But in my mind, I was thinking, why would you ever say anything about this man? He's having fun. And I give him a break. Who would want to be working, you know, doing these things? He's having fun with his friends. You know, there's nothing wrong with what he's doing. So obviously, even as I was growing up, the viewing of, like, having fun, life sucks unless you're just experiencing it. You're having fun. Yeah, I know, I think in the 12 and 12 it says something, you know, about, you know, the character building is the point. You know, I didn't know that. I thought fun. I thought getting what I wanted. Getting more. No drudgery. No responsibility. That was what I wanted. All right, so you have a little background of, you know, how I viewed, you know, fun. Everything's fun. The more fun. You know, other substances came into play too, because I wanted to be wide awake drinking fun. I could have more fun longer. I did graduate by the skin of my teeth. Fear again, because what the heck am I supposed to be doing now? I really didn't have any training. I really didn't have any confidence in myself. More things came into play that made me have more fun faster and longer and forever. And I started getting scared for my physical health. You know, well, the one thing is drinking was always a constant. Do you know what I mean? It just really was. Once I start, it was always there. It was just always there. It was always a part of my life. But I started getting scared for my physical safety and thought, you know, I had an opportunity. Somebody offered me a position, like a job up in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. I had never been to Pottsville. I had no idea about it. It was working in the coal industry. I knew nothing about coal. And I said, sure, fine. I'll do that. You know what I mean? So there's the thing, oh, good, I'll be all right. Just get me away from here, get me away from that bar scene, get me away from this. I'm going up into the mountains, to the coal regions. Within a few days, I found someone who I knew from the University of Delaware, and I was pretty much doing the same thing that I was doing in Wilmington. I ended up, meeting my husband, within 2 weeks of moving to Pottsville. And, I didn't have that conscious thing of this will save me. I really thought the move might save me. When I met him, I didn't think this will save me, but it kind of just did, you did get into that head, well, maybe now I might start growing up. Maybe I'll start outgrowing this. I don't know if anybody else, but I always thought when I was partying and carrying on, I thought I would outgrow it. I had no idea. Something's wrong with me, but I thought I'd outgrow it. I got married. Even the first date I had with my husband, it was, he said something to me about my drinking. The very first, and it was a blind date even. You know, I had to make sure I was okay for this blind date. So, you know, you have quite a few before you even go on the blind date. So my drinking started, I mean, I knew my sisters, I knew my parents had said some things about my drinking, friends had been saying stuff. I've lost friends throughout my college history because I partied too much, they couldn't count on me, I would embarrass them, they'd lose me, they couldn't find me. So, you know, as I said, I started drinking, you know, as I said, the drinking became a subject the first night, and it was a subject until my last drink. During my marriage, you know, drinking was kind of okay, but then you start having children. And at that time, you could still have a glass of wine periodically while you were expecting. Nobody really blinked an eye. You certainly couldn't slam them down, but I did find myself drinking, wanting to drink, wishing to drink, hiding some drinking. Sometimes I could manage to not drink for a little bit, but I always had to drink again, even though I didn't want to. And it really became apparent. I think this was one of the first times I thought I might have a problem. You're trying to nurse your babies, and you know that you can't be drinking champagne and, you know, all night. And you know when you're feeding that child, you know that child's going to be sick. You do it anyway. But I didn't know. You know, I just didn't know that I couldn't, I didn't know what my problem was. I just thought I was sad, I'm depressed, I want to have fun. And I had no idea. My marriage did not pan out. There was I had a period of sobriety, I thought. He's my ex-husband now, he had said, if you don't stop drinking, I'm going to, the marriage is done. And I knew he was serious, so I tried not to drink. I couldn't stand not drinking. By this time, other things, you know, I put down other stuff because it just didn't seem seemly. You know what I mean? I'm getting older. Like, I could outgrow that to a certain degree, but I couldn't outgrow drinking. You know, that just kept, you know, it just kept luring me back. I stopped drinking, I don't know for how long. My children think that I didn't really, they thought I didn't drink at all while they were in high school. And I didn't, but I would do things like, get a weekend away with girlfriends, and as soon as I got out of that house, you know, drink. I would drink privately, you know, in the thing. I wouldn't drink so much at home. I know for years previous, I did all those things like most of us do. You know, I'd be having a coffee in the morning, but there'd be a beer poured in it, but I'd have the coffee mug, so nobody, my children couldn't tell what was in there. They just thought I had coffee. I did things like, you know, rearrange the beer. You'd drink beer and you think, oh God, somebody's gonna notice. And I would rearrange it all and like push everything around so it made it look fuller. I've gone to the point of, you know, I'd drink Yingling lager with a screw top in the case, and I would drink the beer, put the bottle back in, and screw the cap back on. Do you know what I mean? So anybody who walked by wouldn't notice. And I didn't even think it was weird. Do you know what I mean? That's the weirdest thing. We don't even think it's odd. You just do it. It's kind of weird. Like, when you really think back, the stuff that we thought was normal, you know, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. But the whole time, there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me. And I don't know what it is. Then I went to, you know, started the rounds of the, especially when I put down the drinking, or tried, the psychiatrist, my God, I can't live. I can't live sober. I need something. So then, you know, they prescribed the anxiety, you know. Of course they would. We present ourselves as whack jobs. They're giving us something. that would be. And I never was I honest about what I drank, what I used, any medication any doctor ever gave me, I played with. It didn't work. It was interesting because it never seemed to work. But I was also still drinking along with it, never following the direction of the doctor, never honest. Anyway, my last marriage fell apart. This is odd, too, when I think about it. December 13th, 2009, I had to make sure that I had to go to this function, to my really good friend's daughter's 18th birthday party. And I was embarrassed that I was separated. So what do alcoholics do when they're feeling a little uneasy, a little embarrassed? I had to have a couple beers in the morning. This is a Sunday cold morning, 9 o'clock. I was, first I started with some wine. I had a little bit of wine. Mind you, I decided that even though I was separated from my husband, I decided that morning, because of my ridiculous behavior and my fear, because now Patron tequila. Here I went from, while trying to manage my drinking, and I would drink white wine spritzers and some wine sometimes, and went through that period where I could kind of manage it in the Ativan and all that other kind of stuff. But as soon as I got separated, all bets were off. I mean, wouldn't you drink too? My marriage has fallen apart. The watcher, the protector, the person that kept, always looking at me, how much have you had to drink? How much have you had to drink? How much have you had to drink? That was gone. So I didn't think it was odd that I had to start driving around with Patron tequila in my car all the time, because somebody might not have it where I go. But this is the ridiculousness of our thinking. I couldn't explain it. There's something odd going on here. But the denial, the not even knowing. The other thing is, too, by this time, I had tried to get two of my sisters into rehab. They were both in AA. But I didn't drink like them. My one sister wouldn't drink before 5 o'clock, because she read in Good Housekeeping, if you don't drink before 5 o'clock, you're not an alcoholic. So she would drink to a pass out every night, but it wouldn't start until 5 o'clock. I mean, by the time she got into the program, it was starting to inch up to like 3 o'clock. And then my other sister was, she would drink, starting in the morning, cases and cases of beer all day, you know what I mean? And she couldn't function at all. But that wasn't me either. So I didn't even think that I might be an alcoholic. My drinking was more bingey. Sometimes I could kind of make it through. But by this time, as I said, the Patron, by that time it kicked in, I started saying, I turned to my children and said, I'm drinking too much. And they're starting to say something to me. You're always drinking. So I said, all right, I'll try not to drink. I was really having a hard time not drinking. I started saying, God, hangovers are getting really worse than they ever were. But I think it was because I was actually having a little bit of the... I didn't know that. I just thought hangovers got worse. But it was getting to the point I had to drink the next day. And I hadn't really had that before. Periods, I would do that, but now it was here. My last drunk, anyway. I had gone back to my other home. I decided I was going to move back in. I made a quick phone call. This is it. I'm not being separated anymore. I'm moving back in. So that morning I decided he must have had a party the night before. There was wine glasses all over the place. And he was at his girlfriend's. But I was going to go home and be a good wife. This will fix me. I'm going to go home and be a good wife. Plenty of people get through infidelities. My delusional mind. And so I wanted to make sure I felt good for this party and started drinking wine. Saw some vanilla brandy in the cabinet as I was putting something away. I said, well, I'll have some of that. Took a couple beers with me to get dressed and went to this party, and I felt good. I had enough in me. I feel good. I gotta watch my time here. Got to the party, champagne. I love champagne. And then you'll know what this is, most likely. The Boilo came out. And Boilo is effectively moonshine. And I was feeling great. My estranged husband ended up showing up at this party, and he said those words, "How much have you had to drink?" And I lost it. Beat him up. Tore his shirt off, threw him to the ground. I mean, it was, like, ridiculous. I mean, it's horrible behavior. Got in the car and said I was going, you know, I need to die now. I just need to die now. And I went back to the house, got the gun out, and thank God I didn't know where the bullets were. I hadn't used the gun in a long time. I used to, you know, do trap shooting and just shooting. And I couldn't get them in. I was too drunk. Slammed doors. Cops were called. Cops were asked to stay away. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Anyway, I ended up in the psych ward that night. I was done. I didn't know what else to do. I knew I couldn't live. I knew I couldn't, you know, the drinking and the bedevilments. The bedevilments were on me. So from there, I went to, they said they were sending me to rehab. Like, why the hell am I going to rehab? I couldn't put two and two together. What am I doing? I don't need rehab. But I decided to do what anybody was telling me. I wanted to be better. I don't know. So I went. And the funny thing is, though, you know, as they were interviewing me and asking me how much you had to drink and how much you drink and what do you use and all that kind of stuff, I said, yeah, I know I drink too much, but that's not my problem. My problem is that I'm having troubles with, I didn't say these words, but they were almost the exact same words as listed in the big book. I'm having troubles with personal relationships. I'm prey to misery and depression. I'm full of fear. I'm useless. I can't seem to be a real help to anybody. You know, that's what I kept fighting in rehab. Anyway, I'm going to speed this up because I'm running out of time and I really might get into the solution. Got out of rehab, did what I had to do, got a sponsor within 2 weeks as they suggested. I thought there was something wrong with his sponsor because she took it seriously, this recovery thing. By this time, I was out four-wheeling, gathered new friends, having fun. And I said, what's wrong with her? There's something wrong with her. She's much too serious about all this. Little did I know, we have to be. I could only stay sober. I went through the steps with another sponsor, not as outlined in the book. She kept looking at me and saying, just give it to God. Just give it to God. I'm like, I would love to. How do you do that? Write a gratitude list. I can't. I don't have any gratitude. How do you do that? I want to do it. But how the hell do you do that? I found that that's what was, I kept saying, I saw people, they would say, this is what I was like. And I'm good now. I would go to meetings. They tell all the big stories. But I'm good now. I'd be like, yeah, I want to be good too. But how do you do it? So eventually I went back to the mean sponsor. Not the mean sponsor, but the serious sponsor. And she read to me line by line from the book. And still at that point, I didn't even understand when I really sat with her and I was willing, because I felt like dying again. I knew I couldn't drink, because if I drank, the rage inside of me, those bedevilments were going to explode. I was sober about a year, and I felt like dying. I knew I couldn't drink. I just wanted a tranquilizer dart in my neck then. Do you know what I mean? I needed something. I can't stand being sober. I hate it. How do you do it? You know, the meetings kept me going for a little bit. The fellowship kept me going for a little bit. But that's not the program. Went through the steps. I finally understood what an alcoholic is and what this program's designed to treat. You know, do I have the allergy? You know, at first I would fight that. Oh, I can't be that, you know. I took some anatomy and physiology. I know, you know, chemistry and biology. An allergy. I didn't care anymore. I had that experience of when I took one drink, I always wanted more. I always had to have more. I didn't stop until I was going to get really, really, really in trouble. And even that wouldn't stop it a lot of times. You stopped when it ran out. You stopped when the sun came up for a few hours, and then you had to have some more because you felt that you needed the hair of the dog that bit you. So I could say, yeah, that did happen to me. How about that? Okay, I understand what an alcoholic is. And the obsession, no matter what, my mind would always tell me it was okay to drink. This time I'll control it. This time I won't get in trouble. This time I'll be able to not have any. And it wouldn't happen. I'd just hang in there and, yeah, give me one. Or I'd sneak off and say, okay, maybe nobody's looking, and, you know, throw one back and then pretend, oh, no, I'm not drinking. When I understood that and that there was nothing that I could ever do to stop that, there was nothing that any doctor has been able to do. I did do that rehab experience, and they're trying to prescribe you these things or whatever. It doesn't stop the obsession to use or to drink. Yeah, that happened to me. Can you believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity? And I wanted to be sane more than anything. You know, do you suffer from misery, depression? You have troubles with relationships? Are you sad? Are you so scared? Yes. AA is designed to treat that. When you treat that, your mind will stop obsessing to pick up that drink or the drug. And if you don't obsess to pick it up, you don't have to really worry about the allergy. You're not putting one in you. You know what I mean? The allergy's still there, but you don't even have to worry about it. When I found out that's what AA was, and that I found that anything I did in exercise, did anything you ever do fix that in that, somebody calls it the it, that thing inside of you that's uncomfortable, that's wrong. Did anything you ever did, does anything fix that? No. Do you want to maybe try to give the spiritual side of life a try? And I said, yeah, but I've been looking spiritually. I've been doing that. I have every book on every religion there is. I wanted to be the chosen one. I wanted to be the one that knew what God was. And I'd be angry and pissed off because I didn't know for sure. And so I didn't think he really existed or really meant anything because I couldn't feel it. But under the lash of alcoholism, we are willing to look, to try this spiritual thing. I said, I might as well. At one point I said, I might as well try being an alcoholic. I might as well agree with him. Everybody's telling me because nothing else seems to be making any sense. I might as well be this. You know, and so then I said, you know, would you like to try the spiritual side of life? You know, and then there's one point that you would, there's a line in the book that says something like, you know, you saw that people that had a spiritual life were pretty happy, confident, helpful, peaceful. These aren't the exact words. You would think that we would have reached for that. You know, but I thought they were idiots. Even though I kept searching for it. But I had this big, you know, I just thought that they're weak. They're dumb. I don't know. I had a weird concept of God. But under the lash of alcoholism, you're willing to look at your concept of God. This is the last stop. Are you willing to try this? And it is true. I took a look. I developed my own concept of God. Actually, I didn't really develop it. It showed itself to me. I was just willing to take a look. The thing is, too, that I know, you know, when I did my third step, I didn't know how to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I have no idea what that is. But I was willing. I had to be. I was going to die. I was going to drink myself to death, throw myself off a bridge, live in misery and pain forever. I had to be willing to just say, all right, I think I'll try. That's all it was for me, my third step. Now the third step seems so much different, you know, but at that time it was just a, you know, hey, I give. You know what I mean? Just I give. There's nothing left. I have to try this. Interesting, when you do the fourth step, especially when I did my fourth step, I found out that I was powerless over my behavior. I had no idea what I was doing. A lot of forgiveness came as I was writing my fourth step, because I could really see, no wonder I acted like that. No wonder I would always drink or use. You know, that feeling inside of me and that trying to make everything the director, you know, if only you would do this and everybody would do that, then I would be all right, and the failure in making people do what you wanted them to do. Instead of, like, a lot of people get really upset in the fourth step, I started seeing that I had no other way to operate. I really didn't. The fear inventory I did, I love that, because everything I wrote down, all of us seem to have the same sort of fears. Fear of being alone, a lot of mine was fear of being wrong. But all my fears, as I did my fear inventory, it all came down to that God won't want me. So even in doing the fear inventory, I had to get a different idea. That helped me to see what my concept of God was again. It was a scary God, that it was it made too hard of terms. You know, so I had to take a look at that. And, you know, my idea of God is that it doesn't like me. It wants to punish me somehow. So that helped me to see, help develop my concept again. Who could ever turn their will and their life over to something that you think doesn't like you? So, as I said, I let go of that old belief. It's amazing when you do the inventory, all your belief systems that you end up seeing, and the things that you swore, you know, you're going to stick to your dying day, and I believe this, so it's got to be. And it's such wild stories you tell yourself. Ridiculous stories that you end up telling yourself, that and you do everything you can to make that storyline come true. And by letting go of the idea of that I know, I had to let go of, you know, first I had to, the surrender was really, I had to surrender that I knew anything. That my beliefs, my ideas of the way the world should look, what people should look like, anything, that had to be let go. I had to, you know, they say we're born again, we're new. Of course we have to be. I had to let go of everything I ever thought about higher powers, about parents, about boyfriends, about the TV shows that I hated because they told you that life was going to be perfect. But you know what I mean? That was part of my resentment. I hated those stupid shows that made everybody happy in life, and it always turned out well. I was so angry because I wanted to believe in that, and it wasn't that. But in the inventory, you find a lot of... And then you do the sex inventory. And by the time I got to that, you looked at your other, your resentment inventory, the fear inventory. By the time you got to the sex inventory, I was like this. I would have run like hell for me too. It's mortifying. I really understood I had no power. I wasn't bad. I was powerless. I couldn't feel anything. I there was something wrong with me, but I wasn't at fault for that. You know what I mean? I had a spiritual malady. I felt it all my life. I've been looking for it all my life, but I was so blocked from it. And then that evil twin, remember I was talking about the evil twin? Yeah, the more I was behaving worse and worse, the more the inside of me was being covered up. They say deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. By the time I went into rehab, I couldn't feel that anymore. It was gone, and I was scared. The real me was absolutely gone. I was devoid of any I think that's where most of us come to in our last hour, and when we finally, the desperation. The real you is gone. And you'll do anything to get back to it. I have a few more minutes. I went and did my amends. Most of them turned out as expected, or with the guidance of my sponsor. She kind of, most of them I actually did. I did the proper, make the first approach with a phone call. I was prepared. A couple of them I did just kind of on the, they just happened to come up. But most of my amends was a phone call. Could I meet you? I need to talk to you. Most of them went as expected, but it was amazing how many people, and it was kind of a beautiful thing, that they would say, yeah, that hurt me. And then they would say more and tell me what else I did and how it affected them. But instead of being afraid of that, it helps right all our relationships. It helped right the way, it keeps me from doing it again, because every once in a while you'll want to go do something again and you'll be like, no, I better not do that. I just made amends for that. It keeps you. Making amends keeps you from repeating the same pattern. It rights relationships. The guilt is gone. Sometimes the relationships don't come back. But everybody's happy. Like, everybody lets go of their guilt about it, too, or their uncomfortableness. Now I run into people, and it's like, hey, how you doing? But there's no tension. There's no promises of trying to make this work out. It's just very easy. They're scary, though. I have to say, it is nerve-wracking picking up that phone, going into, making those arrangements and going to go to somebody's business office and sit there like this at their desk, But it's good, though. I'm going to go into, step 10, 11, and 12. 10 was so, especially right after you got done, you're really doing your inventory. For me to pick up the phone and call somebody, because it says, when we're selfish, when we have fear, dishonest, it says when these things crop up. It doesn't say if these things crop up. If they're going to come up again, we're going to, ask God to remove it. Ask your higher power, get into prayer immediately if you can. Please, remove this from me. I have experience now where just by that quick thought, it can be removed. But earlier on, I really had to call people a lot. And it's different than saying, oh, I'm just going to tell on myself. I know a lot of people say, oh, I'm just going to tell you what I did or how I thought. And that's it. When I go and make a, call somebody to do a 10-step, if I can't see it, I want them to show me where I'm being selfish, where I'm being fearful, where I'm, being dishonest, or especially to myself, my delusional mind, the stories I tell myself. Other people can see it, and I want them to smash me, point it out to me, because that's the only way I can stay well. I the more I do that, now I can kind of just, I can see something. If I have any bit of uncomfortableness, I can immediately get, usually, to what it's all about, and it's always because I'm thinking about me. There was somebody in this group that in early sobriety would always say, and it didn't matter if I opened my mouth. It didn't matter what I said. He would always say, who are you thinking about? Who are you thinking about? It didn't matter what I said. I could say, oh, I would like a cup of coffee. And he would say, who are you thinking about? He's not here tonight, unfortunately, because he would probably be laughing. The 11th step is, for me, the one that's hardest to do. But when I do it, and it's like, in the 11th step, it says, it tells you exactly how to start our day. It tells you exactly what to do at night. We make a plan for the day. We ask God, to divorce us from, selfishness, Get yourself clear. Then write down, make your plan for the day. When you think about that, if I make a plan for my day and stay kind of principled and on task, a lot of my fear leaves. I'm taking care of the things I need to take care of. You know, when I start going, you know, because we're undisciplined. Alcoholics are selfish, self-centered, undisciplined. I love the 11-step promises. We will not burn energy foolishly. We won't tire so easily. That was my whole life. Spin, 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 spin. You know what I mean? Couldn't get anything done. You know, and just spin and fail, spin it. Now, you know, if I do a good 11-step, you know, morning meditation, get peaceful, I can relax, I can smile, and the day can flow. Nighttime, if I can review my day, how did I show up? How did I do? Is there something I could do better? I'm at about the top of the hour, but I'm almost, the one thing about step 12 that has become so apparent for me, if I am spiritually connected, if I'm doing a pretty damn good job, like not a damn good job, I'm not great at this, there's no way that I can't help another alcoholic. I have no power to do this. I have no power to do anything in my life. I was powerless. I absolutely could not successfully do anything. So I hear people talking about, oh, I have to, you know, this is difficult, sponsor. You know, this is difficult, having to help somebody else. I don't feel that way. If I'm spiritually connected, the power is in me. This power is too big. It has to, I feel like it would implode or explode if you didn't let it out. You know, so I know if anybody's struggling with working with somebody else, remember, for myself, I have to remember where the power comes from. It's not me. You know, all I have to do is get out of the way, let it flow. It's too big. I can't contain this. It has to come out. It's the top of the hour. The one thing that I gives me peace, always gives me anytime I struggle. You know, either God is everything or he is nothing. Either he is or he isn't. You know, what's my choice to be? And it's a simple question. And anytime I say, oh, that's right, I forgot. You know what I mean? I forgot about that again. You know, but within a moment, I can just melt. And everything's good. You know, so for me, God has to be everything. I guess that's all I have. Thanks.